I'm delighted to be back with you, even over Zoom. Feels nice to see all of your faces. I have a master's degree in Buddhist studies and was ordained as a monastic for a little while in Burma, and now I'm ordained as a lay Buddhist minister and serve as an interfaith chaplain. So that's a bit of my background. And I guess what I want to talk about tonight is navigating this time that we're in, and in particular from the perspective of early Buddhist teachings, the early teachings of the Buddha. I wrote an article for the paper a couple of weeks ago, and the title was "We Are All in This Together." And I'd actually chosen the title before COVID-19 happened, thinking that from a clergy perspective, I was going to be addressing the divisions in our society during the election cycle. But this feels like an even more opportune kind of situation to reflect on. We are all in this together. Those words, in their deepest sense, some of you may be well aware of this, but I've seen them sort of recorded or heard them uttered by sages and contemplatives of the Dharmic traditions, and sometimes Christian contemplatives will say this. They can represent a really profound understanding. And it kind of touches on interdependence. The more contemporary Mahayana schools of Buddhism, in particular, talk a lot about interdependence, as do the transcendentalists like Thoreau and Emerson. But recently, I don't know about you, but I've seen "We're All in This Together" kind of around a lot. It's been on public service videos for like public health. It's been kind of a meme that's gone around. I've heard people say it, elected officials say it, and that kind of thing. And I've also seen a pushback, which I think is something worth reflecting on, which is given the stark differences in the rates of infection and sickness and death and financial kinds of impacts that are being shown in our society right now, these words can actually sound kind of naive or even insensitive. So what I've been reflecting on is how any people who might be inclined towards this sentiment of goodwill towards others that these words kind of imply, how each of us might contribute to making them real. Real for everyone, and just in our own small way. I'm not talking about huge, grandiose kinds of things. So I'll offer a few reflections on what teachings in early Buddhism had to offer about this. I think now is a time that it might be wise to kind of reflect on our collective karma as a species, as a planet, and early Buddhist teachings don't call karma collective karma, but some of the teachings do point to that. And I'm going to point to some of the very simplest ones that talk about that, with karma meaning action, and then vipaka meaning result. So there is a discourse called the Saddaka discourse, and many of you have heard teachings from this before. It's part of actually the Vinaya. In Buddhist teachings. So it's the teachings that are preserved of the Buddha and of other wise disciples specifically for the Buddhist order. And a lot of them explain why certain guidelines came to be. And in this particular sutta, the Buddha taught the acrobat simile. I know many of you have heard this. So in ancient India, acrobats did this very dangerous trick where they would have this long bamboo pole, and One acrobat would be on the ground balancing the pole on his shoulder or even on his head, his forehead. I've actually seen that done. And the other one would be on top of the pole. So this is a very precarious position. You got to really know what you're doing, right? And there's a conversation the Buddha relays between these two acrobats. It goes something like this. I'm pulling it up. Anything I draw from here is a translation by Andrew Olinsky. Talks about the bamboo acrobat. There's a senior one and a junior one. And the senior one says to his assistant, "You look after me and I'll look after you. And with us both looking after one another, protecting one another, we'll show off our skill, receive some payment, and safely end our trick." And hearing this, the assistant, she replied to him, "That won't do at all, master. You look after your balance, and I look after my balance. And then, with each of us looking after ourselves, protecting ourselves, we'll safely do our trick, collect our money, and go on." Now, for years on retreat, I heard this teaching as something to the effect of, look to your own balance. And it may appear that way somewhere in the discourses, but in this actual teaching, the Buddha says something a little bit different. And that difference I thought was interesting. The Buddha goes on to say, just like the assistant said to her master, "I will look after myself," so should you, monks, practice the establishment of mindfulness. You should practice the establishment of mindfulness, saying to yourselves, "I will look after others." Isn't that interesting? He goes on then to rhetorically say, looking after oneself, one looks after others. And looking after others, one looks after oneself. So both of them were right, both acrobats. Buddha asks a rhetorical question, and so how does one look after others by looking after oneself? And he says, well, by practicing mindfulness, by developing it, by doing it a lot. And I just want to unpack this for a few minutes, right? So most of you know that mindfulness is a really practical way of keeping track of what our bodies are doing while they're doing it. You know, there's that refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta, that part which talks about being mindful, walking to and fro, being mindful, reaching, being mindful, turning, being mindful, eating. It's kind of encompasses everything, right? It's a very practical way of protecting self and other, being mindful of hand washing, being mindful of touching surfaces, being mindful of touching one's face, of how closely my body passes another person's in the grocery store aisle, by whether or not I cover my face before I walk into the store to begin with. So there's very practical ways looking after my own mindfulness looks after others. And then there's the level which many of you experienced practitioners are quite familiar with, which is looking after our own internal lives, looking after the internal ecology, the emotions and the mind, noticing reactivity before it leaps out of my mouth, or worse yet, through an action. One of my teachers says, you know, in the Zen tradition, they often talk about saving all beings. But this kind of mindfulness, this kind of restraint saves all beings from me, right? From my actions. The next level the Buddha recommended was developing mindfulness. And what does that mean right now in this era? Well, when I think about developing mindfulness, many of you have probably heard this term. It includes not just sati, the Pali word for mindfulness, it also includes a second word, sampajanya. And sampajanya, sati sampajanya are often said together, and that is because they are mindfulness and clear comprehension, or mindfulness and, I actually prefer this translation, awareness of context. So by now we know that mindfulness of context is very important, right? One doesn't do one's slow walking meditation across a busy street. Mindfulness of context. Mindfulness of context right now includes remembering and appreciating that during this pandemic, by protecting ourselves, we are protecting others. Those of us fortunate enough to have safe shelter, and it appears everyone on the screen here does, we're sheltering in place. California has successfully flattened the curve, so much so that it is supporting other members of the community. I have a number of friends who are nurses and doctors, and their lives are directly impacted by the restraint and choice to shelter in place, or the choice not to. And not just their lives, of course, but the life of any person who needs their care, because no matter what one might need right now, having resourced available medical professionals is a really wonderful thing. Mindfulness of context includes the bigger picture, right? So one of the things that's been a learning for me that I'm really practicing mindfulness with is mindfulness of how much I order delivered, right? Who's delivering that, and what level of risk are they taking on my account to protect me? And it's not to say I shouldn't order online, I certainly do, but maybe that trivial thing that I don't really need right now can wait a little while, right? So it's mindfulness of the bigger picture of what's entering into my home, what's entering into my mouth. There's another kind of mindfulness that of awareness of context that I've noticed and that other teachers and spiritual counselors have noticed, which is awareness of what's happening outside of our bubble, right? We here in the Bay Area are so blessed in so many ways with what we have here. And in some respects, we do live in a bubble. And then, as a gentleman put it in a large volunteer support call yesterday, it feels like now with Zoom and sheltering in place, we're all in bubbles within bubbles, bubbles within our bubble. And it's like just a little bit harder. You know, we're interconnecting with each other, of course, but it's different when we're tiles on a screen than when we're in person, we're walking down the street, we see each other. And there's another layer to that as well, that there are often enough people in our spaces, whether they be virtual or actual, who may not feel permission to name their suffering, especially right now. I talked to a practitioner a few days ago, maybe only a day ago. I support people as a chaplain, right? And this person was explaining that they did not feel comfortable telling the communities of support that they're involved in, the sort of spiritual support, that they had COVID-19 and that they're actually really sick and that their landlord is agitating them for their rent and they don't know when they're going to be able to pay it, because they might make other people in the room uncomfortable. It feels like they didn't want to steal focus from other people and their problems. So I think the reason I bring this up is just to invite all of us to an increased level of receptivity for people in our lives that may or may not be doing well and may or may not feel permission to say it. An invitation for mindfulness of context to include compassionate listening and an invitation to connect in ways that might feel safe for the more vulnerable people in our communities and neighborhoods, sanghas, whatever other kinds of groups we're in. It's a bit of a tall order these days, right? Coming into alignment with what is actually happening. And for myself, I find it useful, just like with meditation practice, to turn towards the difficult, touch it, and if necessary, touch it lightly and give it some space. Touch lightly, give it some space. Titrate, right? It's so easy to get sucked into the headlines and the anxiety and the fear and the gloom and the doom and the blah, 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 right? That a certain kind of, for me, as someone who loves to know what's going on, renunciation is really healthy for me right now. I've been calling it a digital diet or a digital fast. And overall, mindfulness of context is not arguing with reality. It's letting it in. Not all the time necessarily, but being present with what's now, being present with that it's okay to be happy with enforced simplicity. It's okay to be delighted that I have more time to work in my garden or whatever it is. This too. The third recommendation the Buddha made for protecting ourselves through mindfulness and protecting others by looking after ourselves is by doing it a lot. I love that translation. Not that mindfulness is necessarily always something we do, but it gets to the idea across, practicing it a lot. For some, perhaps for some of us here, for myself certainly, we're facing the benefits and the challenges of solitude, of living alone at this time. And maybe not seeing a live other person very often at all. And for others who may well also be in this virtual room, it's a different kind of challenge of being with those we're in relationship with or those we happen to cohabitate with all of the time, which is different than many households kind of function based on ships passing in the night or people just being out a lot and there's much more space. Either way, it's this opportunity to turn attention towards both the routine and the crucible of our lives, of like whatever tests us and whatever routines we've fallen into. And I don't know about you, but personally, I've discovered some unfinished business. And that's on the practical level and on the emotional level too. So, you know, those few boxes that just never quite got unpacked when I moved in a year and a half ago, those are there. And the contents of those and why they weren't unpacked is also there, right? Deferred projects. The relationships that somehow didn't quite manage to keep maintaining them when I was so busy. And now there's time to make that phone call, to check in with that person. In some ways, delightful, and in other ways, a reckoning or a bit of truing up with why priorities have been the way they are. And maybe a glance into what they might be in this time of enforced simplicity. Then there's the emotional level. And many people that I've listened to over the last weeks have experienced a lot of emotions, loss, grief, anger, shame, fear, anxiety, helplessness get triggered much more easily. The eight worldly winds are in full effect. I will be speaking more about the Eight Worldly Winds actually later this week. I'm doing a Dharma talk at Coastside Vipassana on Wednesday, if you want to tune in and hear that piece. But I bracket that out as a whole separate talk of internally navigating the eight worldly vicissitudes right now. There's also, though, people talking about practitioners, really lovely to hear, discovering the reservoirs of calm, of simplicity, of equanimity, the ability to draw on this practice and really see how it has prepared them for more solitude and more space. People who are just drinking in the space to meditate, delighting in the solitude and seclusion. In either case, we can be with the busyness, like some people who have, you know, six sequential Zoom meetings in a day. We can be with the relationships that are suddenly much more up close or suddenly much further away. My beloved sister and her family who live in San Francisco, we usually see each other every other week, minimum. I haven't seen her in person in quite a while, right? But we can be with it. It's an opportunity to cultivate and notice how we're responding. Whether it's formal or informal practice, whether it's more interrelatedness or more solitude, a vastness and silence within, or an increased relational mindfulness in the flow of daily activity and constant communication. Speaking of daily activity, this is from an interpretation of the Therigata, the first free women is the title of the book. Wonderful scholar Maddie Weingast. And this is the story of enlightenment story or little poem of a woman named Patachara. And I'll give her backstory a little later in this Dharma talk. But she's talking about, you know, it's spring. Farmers turn up the soil, plant seeds, and wait. All by itself, water pours down from the sky and turns earth into food. I keep all the precepts and always wake early. I don't pretend to know more than I do. And when others ask for help, I do what I can. After all these years, where's my harvest? Then, late one evening, I was washing my feet after another long day of sitting and walking. The water poured over my feet and onto the ground. I let my mind go. And it flowed downhill with the water toward my little hut. I went inside, sat on the bed, and lowered the wick of the lamp. All by itself, the flame went out. That was the end of her delusion and the beginning of her awakening. Part of what I love about that story is, what is she doing? She's washing up at the end of the day. And boom. So there's just tremendous possibility for those of us who have simpler lives to invoke more mindfulness in these times. And sometimes, unasked for completely, insight will pop, right? When I'm washing my hands or brushing my teeth or out on a walk or whatnot. Any moment. I think it was Ajahn Chah who said, and one of you can correct me if you know differently, enlightenment is an accident. Meditation makes you accident prone. Isn't that nice? So overall, to take some time to appreciate whatever you're doing in your practice. And the ethical integrity, the generosity, the wisdom of whatever form of shelter in place, seclusion, or physical distancing that you can use to protect yourself and protect others right now. It might not feel like anything, but the impact is huge. And we've all seen, I bet, examples of this, whether it's on television or the internet or in person, but have you noticed that the natural world is bouncing back? It's taking up space that we used to take up. Whether it's the sheep wandering down the main street of a village in Scotland, or the wild turkeys taking over the streets of Redwood City, or the coyote in my backyard. Nature is taking up space that we have allowed. That wasn't our intention, but it's a nice side effect. So appreciation of what is right in this time and appreciation of your own ethical integrity in your practice is really a beautiful thing right now. And that gets me to the second part of that teaching in the Sadaka Sutta, which is, how does one look after oneself by looking after others? And he answers, by patience, by non-harming, by loving kindness, by caring for others. All beautiful qualities. And non-harming is kind of, to me, the pith, the shortest summation of Buddhist ethics. If you had to have two words that summed up Buddhist ethics, I think that could be it. Non-harming. So, it makes total sense that qualities like patience, loving kindness, care, non-harming protect us. We're far less likely to run afoul of other people, right? Whether sheltered together or out and about. I can't read what the note I jotted down here. Oh dear. Ah, yes, protection. So there's a little bit of that wisdom kind of embedded actually in the myths, the fables, I think of them as, in the commentaries on these suttas. There's a whole class of suttas and chants that are kind of used as invocations of protection in the more classically Buddhist countries where Buddhism is practiced more devotionally. And I got curious about this because the two I've run into, it's, you know, not really my thing to think in terms of protective chants, but the two I have run into, both of the origin stories of them talk about loving kindness and other beautiful qualities of heart. So I'm going to pass along just a brief myth of one of them. It's a story in the Nidesa, and it's actually grounded in historical fact. Back in the time of the Buddha, this city or city-state, I'm not sure which, it was sort of like this tribal flux of power dynamics going on in ancient India then. This city-state was struck by famine, pestilence and plague, and evil spirits, according to this myth, okay? Now, the king basically asked the Buddha to come, and the Buddha came with Ananda. And the story basically is that the Buddha's presence and Ananda's presence, they brought with them a lot of water in the form of a rainstorm. And then Ananda went around the boundaries of the city with water, cleansing it. And the rainstorm washed away the many corpses and other kinds of things that were causing the plague. But the most important effect that the commentary says is that by coming, they instructed the populace of the city in the practice of loving kindness towards one another. And that practice banished the plague, the famine, and the evil spirits, all three. Now, I personally don't really orient myself towards spirits, but it's not hard to imagine how loving kindness and compassion as a practice might help people lessen the impact of the plague. It might help people get through hard times, shortages of food, and evil spirits, whether they be human-born or these large forces of greed, hatred, and delusion that romp like demons through our culture today in the form of just really horrible language and attitudes towards others, that loving kindness and compassion are a really beautiful way of counteracting those. We have our own demons today. We just don't call them that anymore, right? So, science too suggests that cultivation of mindfulness, kindness, compassion, and care, especially mutual care, directly protect us. I'm talking here about how these traits, these habits, correlate directly with stronger immune system, reduced social isolation, and other markers of longevity and happiness. It's really a beautiful thing that offering something like that in the community not only potentially brings more years and corrects for other lifestyle effects, at least statistically, but it tends to make us more satisfied, happier, and connected while we're doing it. That's pretty cool. So this gets me to more of the sati, the mindfulness directed outwards, right? Or inwards and outwards. Meditation is only one part of Buddhist cultivation for the people who are most developed in the practice. Many of you, I'm sure, know that in lay countries, the main practice of lay people is generosity. And I noticed when I spent time in these monasteries that the practice of generosity and even the practices of chanting, but the sort of giving over, really cultivated caring, kindness, beautiful qualities of the heart and mind through action in these followers, some of whom didn't meditate except for maybe now and then on a full moon day once a month. But they learned how to express these qualities, and it was like the expression of them built them further, and there's this virtuous cycle that happens. Or there's just my grandma's advice, who would say, "You want to feel better? Go help someone." She was right. So now, in this time, something I'm finding personally very useful and supportive of me is to offer help to others. I'm not exaggerating to say it is one of the primary sources of joy in my life right now. It's so satisfying. And I think perhaps part of why it's satisfying is there's so much that feels big and uncontrollable that doing something in my own circle of influence just feels really good. Feels simple and good. And each of us have the opportunity to do this, to engage in some kind of social solidarity during this physical distancing. It honors our common humanity, right? And that can be, you know, donating to a food bank or calling a sick neighbor or checking in on an isolated other in your extended social circle. There's all kinds of ways. It's checking in on the vulnerable. And speaking of vulnerability, as all of you know, some folks right now, out of compassion or professional calling or sheer necessity, are immersed in people-facing places. They support our collective health and well-being, whether they be doctors, nurses, delivery folks, grocery folks, factory workers. I believe it's in our collective and personal interest to try and support them any way we can. And you hear beautiful stories of people doing this, people who don't have a lot of money necessarily to offer. I can't remember who it was, but someone was talking about how they've been making masks and they leave a little basket of them out on their front porch with a sign offering for the delivery people to take one if they need one. And gradually their store went down and down and down, and now they're replenishing it. It's like, what a practical, beautiful little gesture, not so little gesture. I don't know how long it would take to make a mask. I don't have a sewing machine. So another I heard about was a person who just put a giant sign up in their neighborhood to remind people that they were cared about. And where they were on their block happened to be right at the beginning. So anyone to come down this cul-de-sac had to pass that sign. Or perhaps you all have heard of the 8 o'clock thing. I don't know exactly what to call it, but it's a thing in San Francisco and some other cities right now where at 8 o'clock proper, everyone goes to their windows or doors and takes a noisemaker or a musical instrument and plays it. And it's a form of knitting together a common experience, but it also was started as an expression of gratitude for healthcare workers. So it's kind of cool. There are others too who have to gather close together, though, besides the healthcare workers. People in shelters, camps, retirement homes, factories, jails. Epidemiology and tracking clearly shows, speaking of collective karma, that by protecting their health and well-being, we're protecting all of our health and well-being. Slowing overall transmission and taking care of those who are most at risk is taking care of me too, and you. So the collective karma, aside from enlightened self-interest, compassion has inspired me to start to raise my voice to protect the most vulnerable. And this can take all kinds of forms. In the interfaith clergy community I'm part of, we actually contact city councils and state representatives and advocate for the most vulnerable. But it doesn't even have to be that, though it could be. As simple as talking with friends or neighbors, or just checking in on folks, right? Caring for others is actually in the Buddha's teachings. Again, this is a part of the teachings not as many people refer to. This is a Vinaya Sutta where the Buddha and Ananda are visiting a kind of further out group of monks. So I don't know, like the monks kind of scattered out into these different pods after a while because there were so many of them, right? And in this community, they come upon a very sick monk. He's alone in his hut. He's soiled. He's got dysentery. He's awful. And the Buddha and Ananda clean him up and tend to him, change his bed. And then the Buddha goes out to the community and makes an announcement. And what he said, I think, is so striking. These are his words in English, of course. Whoever attends on the sick, attends on me. Whoever attends on the sick, attends on me. We may well still tend to the Buddha this way, right? In some sense. if by caring for the sick and the vulnerable, whether it's in person or more and more these days not in person, by caring for those who are having difficulty, we're increasing the amount of compassion, of bodhi, of spirit of awakening, potential in our society, in our hearts, in our minds. Not just in that person, but most importantly, in some ways, for the practice in ourselves as well. Unfortunately, that monk died, the story says. However, he did have the benefit of receiving teachings from the Buddha on his deathbed and became fully enlightened before passing away. It's pretty good, really. But it points to another piece of this, which is Maranasati, contemplation of death, which may or may not be right for anyone at given certain circumstances or times. It's not right for everyone at all times. But it's a powerful practice. And I feel honored that in my service as a chaplain, I've been able to be with people at that stage of their lives. It's deeply sacred. Right now, it's not possible to be with people at that stage for most of us. However, if your practice feels like it might need some sharpening, some motivation, one beautiful way to do it is to contemplate death. And that can be done through contemplating the unfortunate who have died of this particular pandemic, or it can be done by contemplating the inevitability that all of us go. And that tends to sharpen the mind, to pull us back into the present moment. I know for me, it's been a very powerful motivator for my own practice. And it is one of the practices listed in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the discourse that's kind of foundational for our tradition. I think you folks have heard me read this before, but I can't resist. What I'm pointing to is looking, glancing, even touching in to see the larger shape of the cloth, the size of the cloth, as Naomi Shihab Nye says. This is her poem, Kindness. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read parts of it. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like a salt in weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the regions of the landscape can be between kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow is the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it until your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So many of the Buddhist teachings point to the larger cloth. can be seen from the perspective of how loss and grief can condition deeper kindness. And it can also be seen from the perspective of karma vipaka, or conditionality. Just as it's helpful to look both ways before walking across the street, it can be wise to look upstream and downstream at decisions, actions, policies, whether personal or societal, to see what contributed to the current situation and to see what might be the likely effects of a decision or action or policy, personal or societal. I love that the Buddha taught Rahula, his 7-year-old son, this principle. And he used it using the example of a mirror, saying a mirror is, you know, asked Rahula, well, what's a mirror for? It's for reflection, Dad. Okay, so before you do something, while you do something, and after you do something, reflect on it. Will, is, did this lead to benefit, this action, or to affliction? Was it beneficial for me and for the other person, for both of us, for all concerned? Or was it afflictive for me, for the other, or for all concerned? Well, this very simple kind of operating principle, if it's beneficial, do it. If affliction results, stop doing it and learn from it. In terms a 7-year-old can understand, right? I like this as a helpful guide for personal action. And I'm a little bit older than 7, a lot older than 7, right? And it also is a helpful, for me right now, sort of assessment of where do I put my energy? Where do I hope to influence dialogue in my circle, in my neighborhood, in my town? I might ask myself, for example, what are the upstream contributions to our eroded safety net right now? How can we address it? Or simply, what impulses or actions are arising in this heart right now, this mind, and how might they be of benefit to myself, others, or all of us? If so, amplify it. And being human, what are the forces that are arising that are detracting, that are afflictive to myself, to those around me? Maybe notice those. Be kind to the pain underneath them and let them go. So in short, so many of the Buddhist teachings and practices highlight that how we relate to what's happening right now matters. We each have a choice as to how we weather this moment, this mind state, this difficult time. So personally, in that process, I find contemplation to be helpful. And so one of my contemplations is, how can I navigate through this time in a way that this experience results in my becoming stronger, wiser, kinder, maybe a little bit freer? That contemplation comes with an aspiration. How might this life become more of a source of and a force for kindness, compassion, wisdom, awakening, and peace in the world, no matter how small? How can it be a force for that? So I invite you to contemplate How do you want to co-create the change that is germinating in you right now in these strange and difficult times? What attributes do you hope to condition? What attributes do you hope to increase? So I think that's enough. Thank you for your kind attention. If you like, you're more than welcome. We have a few minutes, I think. I'll end us early in honor of the fact that we didn't get our break. But if anyone has questions or if anyone has ideas about how they either aspire to use this time or are using this time, I would love to hear your voices. So maybe, I think we're on one page, so if you want to, you can wave your hand and then unmute yourself. Okay, Veda?
I just wanted to say that a number of people who are able to, and that's not everybody, are thinking of donating at least part of their stimulus check to a food bank or to a something or other. Just throw that out as something that we can think about. It can only be $10 of it. Whatever we can, if we can. Just a thought.
Beautiful. Thank you. And Tom, I think you also had your hand up. Is that right? No? Okay. You were just moving your hand. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Complaints are also welcome. Yes, Barbara and Bill.
It's funny. Part of what's been going on with me lately is just appreciating nature, as you say, able to be with us and the air particularly. Yes. But I also have learned this is a good opportunity to be mindful of this and see how, before I know it, I'm grasping after, oh, where's the next great smell? And, oh, where's the next coyote I can look at? And just being able to watch my own reaction and realize, dukkha's always there in one form or another. And just to be able to sort of go with that and be pleasant and unpleasant, that's been sort of a practice, and I've appreciated it as a practice lately.
Thank you. Yeah, dukkha can take all kinds of forms, subtle and not so subtle. Any other observations from people about this time or what you're noticing in yourselves or your environment? Yes, Corey?
Oh, just the gratitude practice. I mean, it's interesting. It almost feels more natural in this time. That gratitude practice almost is just a natural outcome. I mean, and maybe it's just being in the Dharma milieu, but there's just something about it when you notice people that are just really, they're out there on the front lines, you hear these stories, of people that are sick or know somebody that knows somebody at least. And, it's just very touching, and it really kind of brings that gratitude home more than, it's not a dry practice. It's a much more alive practice right now, it feels like. So that's kind of been up for me a lot lately. And then I'm wondering, it's interesting. I've often thought too that to boil down sila is really do no harm, yet the practices are much more active in doing good. Generosity, loving kindness, all the practice, they're much more active. So I wonder if you have any reflection on that.
So thank you for the beautiful invocation of gratitude. at this time. It does feel more natural. Let me think about, so with sila, sila and vata conduct, not that that's the only Buddhist ethical lens, of course, kindness, compassion are as well, but I guess I usually see the fundamental sila principles as being more in the order of renunciation, of absence of harm, like not engaging in harsh speech, not taking what's not given. And I think the beautiful thing that you maybe pointed to in what you were saying, Corey, is that each of those has a positive correlate. So, for example, not taking what is not given, the full expression of that, the positive expression of that is generosity. And non-harming, the full expression of that can look a lot of ways, but one way it looks is celebration of life and diversity, actively nurturing. And each of them, you can explore for yourself what for you the flip side is. But for me, it's almost as if they're different ways of stating the same thing. And depending on how you orient towards the world, one might resonate more than the other. You know, compassion is sometimes described as the absence of cruelty, actually. And metta, we use the phrase loving kindness, but the cognate in Pali has much more to do with lack of ill will. So it's actually much broader, right? So those are my reflections, but I'm sure others here could add to that. Any other thoughts that emerge? Yes, Shia? Hi. You're muted.
Okay. What I find at the moment is that I know people who, given their living situations, either feel isolated or feel inundated because there's too many people around and they can't stand it. And they're not necessarily practitioners, but one thing that can be done is, which I try to do, is not solve it, but be a sounding board for those people, because I've decided I can't solve the situation usually. The situation is what it is, but those people I find benefit from just being able to talk to somebody, and I try to make myself available to be that person to talk to. If they want.
Beautiful. So being with them rather than trying to fix or change, but just offering support.
Yes.
And, yeah. And that is, to my mind, that's a real gift. The gift of bringing the gifts of our practice to others through this non-judgmental presence, this capacity to really attend to people when they're having difficulties without needing to change them or fix them or anything like that.
Yeah. And also there are people who are in financial difficulties as well. Mm-hmm. And I can't fix their financial difficulties. And that's tougher in a certain way because, you know, there's you know, the economy is what it is, and hopefully it'll get better. But just listening to people talk about, even in my family, I have children who are having financial difficulties because they can't work. I mean, the world is full of all kinds of difficulties, and just to listen and maybe chime in with some money or maybe do something else, but that's what I can do.
Yeah. It is. And that's something each of us can do, regardless of our circumstances, right? So it's right. Beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful that you're remaining open to that, to turning towards the difficulty rather than compounding it, where some people feel isolated because all of a sudden no one wants to hear it, right?
Right.
So are there any other last comments or questions? I want to make time for our metta practice too. So